I am personally fascinated by the questions of canonization. And not so much which books become holy writ, but even to the detail of phrases and sentences and verses that we sanctify. So I've pointed out before in the early parts of Genesis, there is a gold map. It tells us which rivers to follow to find the finest gold. And at the beginning of this week's second Aliyah that we read today, there are instructions for trenching and building latrines, which we might think of as non-sacred material, more the domain of water engineers and Peace Corps volunteers. I guess when I was working in the Peace Corps, I was doing Torah Erech Mitzvot. But we're told as we enter into battle, we should beware of people having unseemly emissions, among other things. I'll try to put that in as gentle language as possible, and we should keep a trenching tool available to prepare our bodies, to which our sages immediately render allegory. They say the trenching tool is your fingers, and you're supposed to go like this when you hear gossip. But I think Torah exists on many levels, but I think clearly it is also existing on the physical and the carnal. And it is telling us something about the sanctity of the body and an awareness of the things in which we ingest and the things which we excrete, and the necessity of being alert to our body, its vessels, its capacities. You know, as we have the blessing that we say after using the bathroom, describes us as having vessels and portals, and were one of those vessels to explode or one of those portals not to open, we could never stand upright and praise God. I think, and as Daniel Boyarin says in his book, Carnal Israel, more than any other ancient tradition, his thesis more or less is, our tradition praised the body and was beloved of the sensual, the romantic, the physical, the carnal, and not just, I don't want to use carnal, I want to use carnal in its original meaning to mean of the body. So we are told in Midrash that Rav says, Rav Amar, lot not nu hamitzvot, ela letzaref bahem et habriut. The mitzvot were given to refine creation, to refine the created. That we have the Torahitic structure and the rabbinic structure of precepts and commandments and ordinances and practices to make us aware, to make our bodies more whole and pure and correct. And that perhaps, I'll think through the course of this talk, by making our bodies more pure and superlative, we refine the spirit. But I do want to stay on the physical level, because as we discuss, our tradition doesn't really traffic in dualisms of body and spirit till latter strands of our tradition. That early, for example, early traditions about the end of days are always physical and carnal resurrection, not just spirits ascending, but bodies returning. So among the ways in which this parasha acknowledges our embodied presence and the importance of the human being, as E.E. Cummings would say, the human merely being. But I think in contradistinction, our tradition doesn't think that's a mere or a small anything, that this body is magnificent. And I remember when Elchanan was born being shocked that he had the right number of ribs. It seemed improbable that we could reproduce ourselves down to that level of detail. And I was watching a documentary on whales, I guess Adin had left it playing, and thinking about the blue whale and its enormity and the heart, its heart I think is as big as a small car, and the diversity of creation down to amoeba and snails, and how, to me, and my kids are interested in dinosaurs also, that the reproduction or the production of such manifold and diverse life through evolution by natural selection is itself proof of God. That God, through the Big Bang and through evolution by natural selection, in these incredibly fine and precise and simple processes, creates such a diversity of life, is a miracle into itself. So to focus on the human today, we're told that when a person is punished for a crime, when a person is flogged, he ought not receive, he or she ought not receive more than 40 lashes, because it would be debasing. Not just debasing to him or her, but debasing to our perception of what it means to be human. If you call him wicked, says the medieval sage Rashi, all day he might be called wicked if you were to continue these beatings incessantly, and is beaten all day, yet he remains your brother. And you might look at his body and begin to dissociate the torture you do to him and not realize that he is your fellow Jew, your fellow human, a creation of God as well, and that the body must be reserved and endowed with a certain sanctity that is inviolate. So we're also told that an impaled body, one of the most gruesome of ancient practices, and probably what's described for Haman and his sons in the book of Esther, that we often translate as hanged, more likely it was impaled, is an affront to God. It's not clear to me from this mitzvah in chapter 21, which means that Israelites did not practice impaling, but we're clear that leaving a body out impaled is an affront to God. So we're told in Talmud, and Rashi quotes this, that it's a degradation of the divine ruler in whose image man, humankind, is created, since Israelites and others, of course, are God's children. And the analogy, the parable that is offered, is that this is analogous to the case of two identical twin brothers. One became king, the other was arrested for robbery and hanged, and whoever would see the reprobate brother would look at it and say, oh, the king is hanging, that's odd. Which is to say, if we are created in God's image, in the structure of the divine, in that fractal image of all creation through God, to do some violence to our bodies, to do some violence to the created world is in some way, microcosm or macrocosm, to do violence to God. Now, he did have that thought, if it's offensive, why was it done at all? But that's another question for another day. So when we talk about the body, and we began by talking about what goes out of the body, but I think, to quote a supervisor I once had, among the two most important choices we make in life are whom we associate with and what goes in our mouth. Because there, I think what his point was, and I think Kashrut emphasizes this, it's the thing over which we have the most control. Human beings and cats, unlike dogs and other animals, can starve themselves to death. We can choose not to eat. We can choose to eat among limited choices. We can choose to overeat. We can choose to eat poorly. We can choose to eat healthily. We can choose to follow the newest science. I think butter is good for you this week. Or not. And we get, I think it was in Marianne's Torah reading, the questions of gleanings and the leftover parts of a crop. So we're told that if you pass through a vineyard, or a field of grain, you can't take a bucket or sickle, but you can pluck. I don't think this applies at Kroger, but I know people think like fallen grapes are theirs, you know, like this cherry fell, so I'll take that. You can cite, I think it's Deuteronomy 23:25, if they give you trouble about taking grapes at Kroger. And contrary-wise, the converse is that when you reap your field, if you miss spots, you leave them for the poor and the destitute. Which implies something about the relationship of the physical, the ground-created world, and that which walks upon it. That neither owns the other, is what I want to say. And that the body, as I'll point out in a second, is a canvas for important and holy choices, just as the agricultural world is another canvas. So Moshe Avigdor Amiel, who is the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv just prior to the creation of Israel, looks at this description of gleanings and this description of passing through a neighbor or a friend's or a countryman's yard, vineyard, or field, and says, quite prettily, the world is God's vineyard, who placed there all trees sweet to look upon and good to eat. Humankind is permitted to eat one's fill, not only permitted, but it's a mitzvah, and if you were to fast without necessity, that's a transgression. That's the one end of the spectrum. that food is there for our delight, that it's great that we enjoy the scent of cumin and the sweetness of a peach. But as we know in the modern age, we were not evolved to live among plenty. That a peach is sweet because it attracted hunter-gatherer ancestors to pick it, because sweetness indicated density of calories and sufficiency. Right? But our love of high fructose corn syrup can take that too far. So this question, I think, about what is the right amount to take into these beloved and holy bodies is a challenge of the modern age and something I struggle with, something that many of us struggle with, going too far in one direction or another towards many kinds of eating disorders, frankly, but also lack of appreciation for the goodness of the world. That's one of the reasons we say blessings before food. We're told in some traditions that to eat without blessing is to be a thief, or at the very least, an ingrate. So this parasha has the classic story, the Ben Sorer Umoreh, the rebellious, stubborn son who refuses to listen. And he's also described as a glutton. So what the Akedat Yitzchak, who is a late medieval commentator in Spain just before the expulsion, Isaac ben Moses Arama, says that technically he's a thief, not a glutton. But the presumption is he only stole a small amount of meat and wine, and therefore is acknowledged as a reprobate because of his gluttony, not his thievery. The thievery was merely a means to the end of gluttony. I don't know if this is the first instance, but it's one I found in this parsha, of the question of overeating and the question of determining what crosses our lips. And in the parsha, we talk about both what goes out and what comes in. That you must fulfill your vows that come out of your mouth, but you also must be alert to what goes in your mouth. And the question raised by our sages, even in late medieval times, where there was still food scarcity, I would assume, but the understanding that food is a great gift that can be misused, just like all of the gifts of the body. We talk about our tradition being recognizing the significance of the embodied and the carnal, but also setting clear and important boundaries around those things, whether it's the generative act, whether it's eating, whether it's charity. There are limits often on both sides. So that's there, and there is no clear rule, right? You can't eat pork, but you could eat as much mutton as you could possibly withstand. And we know this. We know this in Jewish life. Just as I've said many times, mitzvot, halakha, the Jewish tradition doesn't ensure that you'll be a good person. I think at its best, our tradition is there to set a framework that inspires you or gives you the best possible chance of being a decent fellow. You know, there are places that I think create the environment for poor decision-making. Bonnaroo, prison. And there are, no offense, I know you're, Marianne makes great decisions there. It was a playground for me that whereas I think Judaism and synagogues and Jewish community life creates a framework for the best possible decision-making. It doesn't ensure it. So kashrut teaches us that we have control over what we eat, but it doesn't ensure that we will have control over what we eat. So the Korban Ha'oni, I think, who is a Hasidic commentator, talks about this same verse we're told about eating from our neighbor's grain, eating what we need. Here's the rubric I will leave you with, though I don't think it's prescriptive as much as descriptive. He says, "Eat according to the desire of your spirit, not the appetite of your flesh." Would that you would know the desire of your spirit more than the appetite of your flesh. That's another sermon for another day. But this beautiful body that we are given in all of its myriad shapes, and that we might learn to love it and care for it, is among the many challenges that Judaism sets before us. That God willing, as the psalmist says, we have some 80 years or so, says the psalmist, to live, and in that time, God willing, it should be 120, we master our body, we learn of our spirit, and we learn how to care for the two in tandem. Korban HaOni says, eat according to the desire of your spirit, not the appetite of your flesh. And although that is not concrete, explicit, or prescriptive, I hope over the course of your life it becomes descriptive of the way you engage with the natural world. Shabbat Shalom.